We're starting paragraph 99 today. What we have seen up until now is we've completed our discussion of the Egel HaZahav. The way that we originally had gotten onto a discussion of the Egel was because there was a question that the Khazar king had raised. How could you even suggest that the Jewish people have retained any of their superior status in light of how far they fell with the sin of the Egel HaZahav? And that was the intro, that was the segue from the previous discussion about the special nature of the Jewish people, the fact that we are a unique creature in this world, that we have a specific kind of and unique kind of genetic material, a spiritual kind of essence that is unique and different from every other human being that lives in the world, and that gives us the potential for prophecy. The challenge was, well, if we're so special, how could we fall so dramatically with the golden calf? And that's how Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, when he seeks to minimize the severity of the sin despite the description in the Torah. But there's another agenda that Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi had when teaching us about the Chet HaEgel, and that was to re-emphasize the recurring theme throughout Sefer HaKuzari, which is that no matter how logical your mind works, and no matter how reasonable a certain kind of behavior seems, if it's not prescribed by HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself in the Torah, then there's no guarantee that what you're doing is right. And a corollary of that would be is that no kind of worship that is invented by the individual can ever match up to the forms of worship that are described in the Torah. So, you know, like the example that I always like to give, because I'm from California, and if you like to do interpretive dance on the Bima on Shabbos morning, or you like to play the guitar, you know, with the handheld cymbals and all of these other things, and recite poetry, all of these things may seem really, really spiritual and groovy, but the fact of the matter is that they cannot substitute authentic worship that is prescribed by Hashem. And that is also contained within the story of the Egel HaZahav. That's contained within the story because the Jewish people felt that they could justify doing this form of worship in order to help them get closer to Hashem. They felt that they needed something real, something visceral, something they could connect with in order to be able to worship Hashem on a higher plane. And they therefore argued that they could justify disregarding one of the commandments in order to be able to accomplish that greater good. But when you play those kinds of games, says Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, you ultimately end up at a severe deficit, because the mitzvahs of Hashem are not based upon how they make you feel. Their efficacy is not based upon how they make you feel. They're not based upon logic. They're not based upon how rational they present themselves, but rather there's a certain kind of precision that HaKadosh Baruch Hu built into his universe, and that same precision that we find in the physical universe is the precision that Hashem built into the system of mitzvot. So that just like if even one atom is out of place in a molecular structure, then the entire molecular structure collapses, so too, if even one detail of a mitzvah is lacking or altered in some way, then it causes the entire efficacy of the mitzvah to collapse and fail. So the way that Rabbi Yehuda describes the entire system of mitzvahs, the entire system of the Torah commandments, is based not on the way that it gratifies us or makes us feel, but rather there is a real inherent connection, a cosmic connection between mitzvah, the way that we do mitzvahs, and the way that those mitzvahs reverberate within creation. It's just like a laboratory. You add the wrong measure or the wrong chemical, you end up with a failed experiment, you end up with a failed reaction, So too, when you try to tamper with the mitzvahs, you end up with a failed reaction, and it just won't work. It just won't work. Which is why, no matter how spiritual you feel when shaking a lemon on Sukkos, if you didn't shake an esrog but you shook a lemon, it just doesn't work. You have accomplished essentially nothing for Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi. Okay. So, you know, there's that question. When you want to help your children practice for the mitzvah of lulav and esrog, you don't want to pay for a chinuch set, you know, so should you give your child a lulav and a lemon instead of a lulav and an esrog? Yeah? So there are a lot of rabbis who frown upon that practice because it's bad chinuch, because you're training your child to use a lemon and say that, you know, you can use substitutes for mitzvahs. So sometimes there are those, and I actually subscribe to this based upon my understanding of Yehuda HaLevi. I want my child to understand that there's a certain precision to the mitzvahs that allows for no substitutes. So if I can't afford to buy you an esrog, then you will wait. You'll borrow mine until you're old enough to deserve to get your own esrog. I couldn't believe it. It was the first one of my children. You know, I've always had a policy. Thank God, we've had a lot of boys in our family. So we had a policy that before your bar mitzvah, we get one set of arba minim for all the boys under bar mitzvah, and once you become bar mitzvah, you get your own set of arba minim for Sukkos. And that was fine. And it wasn't, even though I might have been able to make a special deal and I could have gotten each boy his own set, but I wanted them to feel a sense of specialness, that once you become bar mitzvah, you get your own set of arba minim, something to look forward to. And this year for the Afikomen, one of my little Pisher said that for the Afikomen, he wants his own arba minim, which was to me, that's the ultimate nachas, you know. But I'll be sure to get him one without the pitim. we all know what happens when a six-year-old tries to shake a lulav and an esrog with a pitim. Yeah.
We have the same approach with humras, which apply to the mitzvahs.
Well, you know, can you give me an example? Because there's chumras and there's chumras, you know.
You know, we know that we keep laws of Tahara Mishpacha differently than is prescribed in the Torah.
That's true, but I wouldn't call that a chumra. I'd call that a din derabanan. You know, a rabbanan is not a chumra. Okay, a rabbinic law is not a chumra. Rabbinic law is rabbinic law.
The kidneys would be as well.
Oh, so let me. I understand what you're asking now. I'm sorry.
Who can make
the judgment? I didn't understand. Is there cosmic resonance with rabbinic law, right? In other words, if I mix chicken and milk, which is only a rabbinic prohibition, have I dramatically injured the cosmic fabric of the universe in the same way when I cook milk and meat together? Right? Is that really what?
Yeah, and next step, humras, which individuals or communities put on themselves.
It's a very good question. It's a very good question. It would seem to me that from the story of the Tanur Shel Achnai story, which is the famous Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yehoshua dialectic of, you know, if Rabbi Eliezer says, if the law is like me, then let the heavens proclaim it. And, you know, in the whole series of events where he says, if the law is like me, then let the river run upstream. If the law is like me, then let the tree uproot itself and jump 40 cubits. If the law is like me, then the walls of the Beit Medrash should proclaim it, and the walls began to cave in. You know that famous story about the Metzia? We'll do it at some point when I'm sure we'll get to it at some point. But anyway, the point is that, and then Rabbi Yehoshua says, if the law is like me, let the voice from heaven proclaim it. And finally a voice comes out and says, why are you arguing with Rabbi Eliezer? The law is like him in all places. And Rabbi Yehoshua says, we don't contend with heavenly voices. The law is based upon what we proclaim, and there are a number of ways to interpret that story, but the way I've always understood that story is that once God gave us the Torah, he told us that we create the reality of mitzvah observance. In other words, mankind has the ability to change the very fabric of the cosmos through his own interpretation of Torah. If indeed mitzvah observance is something that is as scientifically precise as chemical reactions, the way Rabbi Yehuda Levi is describing it, so then humanity as a collective, we as the Jewish people, can actually redefine how these chemical or Torah reactions work through our interpretation of Torah. And as long as we go through the process that was instituted by Hashem, then we actually are contributing to that, to giving rise to certain metaphysical realities of the universe. We define those metaphysical realities as well. Whether that's true...
Metaphysical plastic.
Yeah, there's a certain elasticity to it. Yes, of course. Mm-hmm. Now, whether that applies to chumras the way that you say, I don't know. But I can tell you that when it comes to issues of chinuch, when it comes to educating our children, going back to that illustration of the lulav and the esrog, I think that it's worthwhile to educate our children with chumras as well, especially if it's a family chumra. But of course, that has to be taken with a grain of salt. That's a good way for us to remember. Let's all turn off our cell phones if we can. So, yes. There are different ways of interacting with the metaphysics of mitzvahs. Sometimes you can accomplish more than others, absolutely. But you know, when it comes to chumras, you know, there's a famous halacha that a person should that we learn from Moshe Rabbeinu, that a child, let's say a woman has a baby and she's not able to nurse properly. So the halacha in Shulchan Aruch is that a person should strive to never have his child nurse from a non-Jewish or a heathen, an idolater, right, is the halacha. And how do we know this? We know this because Moshe Rabbeinu refused to nurse from any of the Egyptian women, right, from the Mitzrios. So the famous question that they ask is, well, how can you bring proof of that ideal from the story of Moshe? Moshe Rabbeinu was the giver of the law. I mean, he was the greatest Jew who ever lived. Maybe that's the reason why he refused to suckle from a non-Jewish woman. How do you use that as an exemplar for only the average Jewish baby? Maybe that was just the case by Moshe Rabbeinu. Why should that apply to every single Jewish child? And the answer is because maybe your child will be the next Moshe Rabbeinu. And I would say you have to be prepared prepare your child to be the next Moshe Rabbeinu. You have to have that kind of attitude in the education of your children as well. Okay, but you know, getting back to this metaphysical reality of mitzvah observance, that the metaphysics of mitzvah observance is just as real as the physics of this world, we're going to see that this is really the connection to Chetah Egel. It is that just like trying to tamper with the mitzvahs of Hashem ends up in disaster, this is true with any mitzvah, and that's why the mitzvahs are so precise. Now, it may be good for us to recall at this point what the debate between Rabbi Yehuda Halevi and the Rambam on this issue. The Rambam, and you can find the citation of the Rambam in the introduction, my introduction to the Kuzari, is that the Rambam seemingly takes a different approach. The Rambam views the mitzvah performance in a more rational way and seems not to place as much stock on the metaphysical value of mitzvah performance, but rather that these are mitzvahs of Hashem. The value of performing a mitzvah is not so much in its metaphysical positive effect that it has on the universe and on me and on everyone else in the world, but rather every time I do a mitzvah, I'm worshiping God, I'm serving Hashem. My deviation from a mitzvah is not sinful because I'm not accomplishing anything metaphysically, but my deviation from a mitzvah is sinful because I've disregarded or I've disobeyed Hashem. Now, do you understand the difference between the two? It's an important distinction. For the Rambam, the details of a mitzvah may be arbitrary. There may be nothing that is metaphysically real about why you have to use an esrog other than a lemon. In other words, if I had, for Reb Yehuda Halevi, if I have metaphysical lenses in my glasses, then when I hold up an esrog on Sukkos, I see an aura emanating from it, and when I hold up a lemon, I see there's no aura coming off of the lemon. You see, but for the Rambam, they're both the same. There's no innate aura that emanates from an esrog any more than a lemon. But here's the issue. God said use an esrog. He said not to use a lemon. By using a lemon, I'm disobeying the instructions of God, and that's what's wrong with what I've done. Not because, for the Rambam, he doesn't dwell on the metaphysical value of the specifics of the mitzvah observance. As a matter of fact, if anything, the Rambam says precisely the opposite. He cites a midrash which he provides as a backup for what he claims, and that is that while HaKadosh Baruch Hu is extremely demanding that we observe 613 mitzvahs, sometimes the details of those mitzvahs, even though each mitzvah has purpose, sometimes the details of each mitzvah may be somewhat arbitrary. And as to provide support for that claim, he cites the Medrash. The Medrash says, here, I'll even show you where the Medrash is. If you go to page 19, this is from the introduction. This is my text, so it's not gospel, okay? If you take a look at the second paragraph, which starts with the words, for example. For example, Rabbi Halevi emphasized the great precision involved in each and every detail of each mitzvah. Nothing is arbitrary regarding what, how much, when, etc. in the performance of the mitzvah. Rabbi Halevi compared God to a doctor who prescribes the mitzvahs as medication. Even the slightest variation in the dosage or the chemistry of the ingredients could kill the patient instead of healing him. On the other hand, Rambam viewed the mitzvahs more holistically. He suggested that while there is great purpose to every single one of the 613 commandments, some of the details of the mitzvahs may be purely arbitrary. As proof, he cites the Midrash, which states, "What does God care if one slaughters an animal from the neck or from the nape?" We conclude that the mitzvahs were only given to purify man. That when Hashem gave us the mitzvahs, they're here to help us, to make us into better people, not to change the world. And therefore, the fact that Hashem said slaughter the animal from the neck and not the nape, which is the back of the neck, is an indication that that's an arbitrary instruction. He wants us to conform to His will. That's why He gives us the details of the mitzvahs. Not because there's anything inherently of value to the neck versus the nape, but rather you have to, in order to become a better person, you need to become an Eved Hashem. You need to become a servant of God who conforms to the exact specifications of the Master. And that's the type of relationship that the Rambam creates when he talks about the mitzvahs. Welcome, and Rav Shlaim, it's good to see you. Okay, so that's the dialectic here that we're dealing with. For Reb Yehuda Halevi, intellect and rationality are not where the Torah is at. The Torah here is not here to stimulate us from an intellectual or rational standpoint. And therefore, for Reb Yehuda Halevi, who has this mystical, cosmological, metaphysical view of the world, even if I don't get any kind of emotional or intellectual uplift from the mitzvah, I should know that there's like an aura that I'm creating, light and magic. And I don't mean that in a deprecating way. I mean this in a very positive way. There's a certain magic that I'm creating in the very fabric of the cosmos every time I do a mitzvah. That in itself should gratify me, even when I don't find any other kind of emotional gratification. Like, I have no idea why I'm parading around shul on Sukkos with this lulav and esrog. It just makes absolutely no rational sense to me, walking around with a palm branch and a citron that I paid over $100 for. Mm-hmm. And if it was on the free market, I could buy this for a fraction of the cost. But because they know that this is the only thing that I can use, they charge me a premium for it, right? So it makes no sense to me. I don't connect to this on an intellectual level. I don't connect with it on an emotional level. I don't connect with it on any other level other than the Halevian level of there's something magical that takes place. And if I just had the right lenses, I would be able to see this amazing aura bouncing off of this Lulav and Esrog, bouncing off of me, and the entire world changing as a result of my shaking the Lulav and the Esrog on Sukkos. Yes?
So I'm having trouble with the Rambam here, because how could the details that Hashem prescribed not be significant beyond getting our obedience, right? In other words, if they're coming from a divine source, maybe we can view them as a hoax. Like, we can't see it, but it's got to be there. There's got to be a state, because how can we presume to know what was in Hashem's mind when he created those details?
Well, it could be that there's a deeper level, that the Rambam may be writing esoterically here, and he also sees a certain metaphysical value. But it shouldn't be surprising. Let's put it into human terms. If I'm the general of the army, there may be certain things that I command of my officers and my soldiers that are extremely logical from the standpoint of military tactics. So, for example, the color of their fatigues has a certain logic to it, because I want to make sure that it camouflages well when they're out in the battlefield. But why they have to wear a certain regulated kind of shoelace may only be because I seek uniformity from my soldiers. Now, that in itself has value, but there's nothing innate about that particular shoelace other than the fact that I require disciplinary uniformity among my soldiers in order for them to be considered to be an army. That's the way the Rambam views a certain details of the mitzvahs. It's, you know, there's nothing special about that particular shoelace, but in order for everyone to be doing the same mitzvah at the same time and with the same way, that's why Hashem told us that specific detail. And you know, the truth is that I remember many years ago when we were young parents, and we went to the doctor, and the doctor had prescribed some eardrops for one of our children who was getting constant infection, and he had just gone through a surgery to repair a ruptured eardrum because it was like, you know, multiple things. And as a nervous parent, the doctor said, put in a few drops. So, like I said, how much is a few? Is that like two or is that 20? You've got to tell, like, in other words, I was annoyed with him because he just said, use a few. And the truth is, a few was actually correct. But we as human beings require parameters in order for us to feel that we're doing something meaningful. And so that's really the Rambam's attitude, I think, is that he's saying that there's a certain kind of human gratification that we need to be able to acquire through the performance of the mitzvahs. And also, we need to feel that we're conforming to Hashem's commands. And Hashem wants us to be able to have a uniform type of religion where not everyone's doing their own thing and interpreting things willy-nilly. So he gives us specifics, even when those specifics may not be more important than just making sure that we're all on the same page. Now, is it possible that the Rambam does see value and he's just not telling us? Come to Ken Green's lecture on Leo Strauss on Maimonides, which will be coming up sometime at the end of June. And Ken Green, who is a professor at U of T but is a member of our shul, and Leo Strauss was the expert of the esoteric nature of Maimonides. There are certain times when the Rambam writes things in the Moreh Nevuchim, and there are certain things that he's writing underneath the surface. But this is at least the surface understanding of what the Rambam is trying to convey. Okay. Yes. And then maybe once that'll be the last question, we'll get into the text. Go ahead.
I agree with Sherry, and I personally always thought that both of those ways of looking at the mitzvot can coexist very peacefully, and that's how I always looked at it, that there is something metaphysical that happens, but we also have to obey because Hashem told us to. And I personally would find it very hard to think that the details are just for sake of uniformity. I mean, Hashem is not like a general in the army. He's divine. So he wouldn't tell us all to do a specific thing just...
Without there being deep meaning and purpose in everything.
Like, I don't see the mushroom that links to himself.
Okay, I hear you. Okay, I can only give over the information as best as I understand it. And that's why I said, Halevi, this is the part of Rebbe Yehuda Halevi that resonates most closely with my way of thinking and how I derive meaning out of mitzvah performance, especially the ones that I don't connect with on an intellectual level.
Can I just add one more thing?
Yeah.
You said that even if nothing metaphysical happens, but if the person is obeying Hashem, that makes him into a better person.
Precisely.
And if that person becomes a better person, then he changes the world around him.
Even
if there's nothing special about an escrow, and he's doing it because Hashem told him to, then he becomes a better person, a better Eved Hashem. Ergo, the world around him is changed.
Well, I don't know about that. You're making an assumption that my change of status affects the world around me.
Right.
That's a Kabbalistic idea. That's a Kabbalistic idea. What if you don't subscribe to Kabbalah?
I don't see why it's Kabbalistic. It's you become a better person, so you change things.
I changed myself.
But when you change yourself, there is always a ripple effect.
It's the chemistry of the cosmos.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but the chemistry of the cosmos, that's mysticism. That's magic. Mm-hmm. And if you're a pure rationalist, as the Rambam professes to be, then that's mumbo jumbo. Let's go on. Paragraph 119. I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just telling you that there's different ways to look at it. Okay? The Kuzari had just gotten through after hearing the error of the golden calf. He said that in paragraph 98, you've already helped confirm my conviction and my thoughts and the visions and my dreams that one cannot achieve divinity, which is by definition a closeness to Hashem, without divine decree. That is, without those actions which God commands one to perform. And let us go on now to paragraph 99. And see if we can get a reader for today. Oh my goodness, we're running out of time. Let's just read a few lines if we can. Go ahead, Sibby.
The rabbi said, "You are right, and all our commandments are written explicitly in the Torah, dictated by God to Moshe. Each paragraph and directive that Moshe handed over to the great assembly gathered in the desert did not require any additional explanations or qualifications, other than what Moshe transmitted to them. For example, he even elucidated the details of the sacrificial laws, how the animals are to be offered, where and on which side of the tabernacle, how they are to be slaughtered, what is to be done with the blood, and the various body parts, every facet involving very detailed laws. Everything was clearly presented by God so that not even one small item would be left out, thereby invalidating the sacrifice."
Now hold on here. It's very important to know that what Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is doing here is cherry picking. I hate to say it, but he is cherry-picking over here. What Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is doing is that there's a machlokas in the Gemara. There's a machlokas in the Gemara between Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Yishmael. And Rabbi Yishmael is of the opinion that only the general laws were given at Sinai, but the pratim, but the specifics, the details of every law, were given later on when the Jews had already built the Mishkan. And Rabbi Akiva disagrees, and he says, and this is the famous Rashi at the beginning of Parshas Bahar, he says that just like all of the details of the mitzvah of Shemitah were given at Har Sinai, so too all of the details of every single law were given to the Jewish people at Har Sinai. And Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is clearly siding with Rabbi Akiva. The reason why he's siding with Rabbi Akiva is because he wishes to emphasize that the specificity of the law is just as vital as the general mitzvah itself. All of the details of every single mitzvah are just as important as the general instruction, because you can't have any value of the general instruction of the mitzvah without all of the specifics added in, just like you can't have a scientist giving or a doctor giving you a general instruction of take some medicine without telling you what dosage and without telling you how to combine the compound, right? Just like that's not going to have any efficacy, so too telling you this is a mitzvah without telling you how to perform the mitzvah in all of its specific details has no value. So it was necessary, it must have been that when Hashem gave us the mitzvahs at Har Sinai, he gave us everything. Because to give us a half a mitzvah without the whole mitzvah is completely without value. And you see clearly here that the Rambam would not necessarily agree. The Rambam might feel just as comfortable as subscribing to Rabbi Yishmael as he would to subscribe to Rabbi Akiva. Because for the Rambam, it's the general mitzvah which is the thing that contains the value. The specifics might not be as important. And therefore, once we become a people gathered around the Mishkan, maybe that's the time for us to get the specifics. So I should actually add that as a footnote. Okay.